Chapter 11. Cornelia. 9:30 in the evening, and only an occasional glimpse of the moon between wind-blown clouds. A cold front was moving through from Upper Canada, and the warmth of spring had vanished from the air. The flower petals had closed, and the river had turned a sullen gray. Cornelia waited impatiently on the dock with Iris beside her. Iris had dressed for the occasion in a white linen dress, a chinchilla stole, and a ridiculous straw hat. She hopped nervously from one foot to the other and chafed her hands together. "Oh, do sit down," said Cornelia. Iris shook her head. "I'll get my dress dirty," she said. "You should have worn something more practical," Cornelia said. "This is not a beauty pageant." Cornelia perched herself on the dock rail and wondered what on earth Iris could be planning, because she was obviously planning something. First, there had been that strange conversation with the young fisherman in which Cornelia had been prompted by Iris to ask all kinds of questions about currents and wind direction. Then Iris had disappeared for a good part of the afternoon on a mysterious errand of her own. She had returned to say that she now had no intention of paying the $10,000, but she still intended to go down to the dock to meet the abominable Mr. Murray. Cornelia shifted her weight uncomfortably. "He's late," she said. "Perhaps he's not coming." "He'll be here," said Iris, wringing her hands. "He's not going to pass up this opportunity." "What are you going to do when he gets here?" Cornelia asked. "Better that you shouldn't know," Iris replied, tightening her grip on her handbag. "Nonsense," said Cornelia. "I know you think you're in charge of the money, but the movement is my responsibility. If you do anything that reflects on the movement, it will reflect on me." "How do you think the movement will look if Evangeline dies?" Iris asked. "She's not going to die," said Cornelia. "She might," said Iris. "Nell McLaren pulled the wool over your eyes, didn't she? She told you that it was easy. She told you that going over the falls in a barrel was just a big joke, didn't she?" Cornelia clamped her mouth shut. No point in letting Iris know that she was right, and certainly no point in sharing with Iris her own doubts about Evangeline's safety. "I would never have recruited poor dear Evangeline if I had known how truly dangerous it was," said Iris, "and I would never have made her sign that contract." Cornelia spared a thought for the 3-page contract that bore 3 imposing red wax seals and Evangeline's name written in turquoise ink. "It's a good contract," she said. "She won't wriggle out of that." "But we could let her out," Iris said, "and then we wouldn't have to worry about Mr. Murray." "You're wrong," said Cornelia. "You don't understand ambition and determination, do you, Iris? You've never been determined, have you? Some women have true mettle and true ambition. Mrs. Murray won't go back on her word. It would make no difference to her if you took the contract and threw it in the river. She'd still go ahead." "You're so weak and wheedling, Iris, that you have no idea what goes on in the mind of a modern, independent woman." "Weak and wheedling," said Iris. "Well, we'll see about that." Cornelia smiled to herself, confident that a crisis had been averted, and there would be no more talk of letting Mrs. Murray out of her contract. "He's coming," Iris whispered. A dark figure was indeed coming toward them, his steps clearly audible on the gravel road. He paused at the edge of the dock, removed his hat, and bowed. It was John Murray. "Ladies," he said. "Don't waste your time with that stuff," Cornelia snapped, taking an immediate dislike to the smile on his face and his general air of victory. "Very well," said John Murray. "We shall dispense with the polite amenities if you wish, and come straight to the point with no preliminaries. Do you have my money?" Iris raised her handbag, and Cornelia felt a twinge of fear. Iris had made it perfectly clear that she was not going to give John Murray $10,000, so what was she going to do? "It's here," Iris said. "I'll look a little foolish carrying your handbag," John said. "Take out the cash and hand it to me." "But I have something for you to sign," said Iris. Cornelia raised her eyebrows impatiently. So that was Iris's plan, to have John Murray sign a guarantee that wasn't worth the paper it was written on? Why had she even for a moment believed that Iris had a better plan? John Murray inclined his head. "Of course," he said. "Something to guarantee that I won't return tomorrow?" "Delighted, I'm sure." "Of course he's delighted," Cornelia snapped. "But what's to make him keep his word?" "Cornelia, dear," Iris said softly, "please don't say any more." But you yourself said it, Cornelia protested. You said there was nothing to stop him from coming back for more.
I know what I said, Iris replied, but I think I found a solution.
A break in the clouds allowed the moonlight to fall briefly on John Murray's face. Looking up at him, Cornelia could see that he was still triumphant. He knew there was nothing that Iris could write on a piece of paper that would stop him from coming back for more money. Cornelia had never known Iris to be quite so naive, not where money was concerned. But it was Iris's money, and she had plenty more where that came from.
"I'll sign anything you like," John Murray said.
"Oh, good, good," Iris twittered. "I do so hate arguments, Mr. Murray. They make my head ache. There's only one thing that worries me, and I do hope you won't think me a nuisance. Do you mind? Oh, dear."
"Do I mind what?" Murray asked impatiently.
"Do you mind walking along the shore a little way? It's just that..." Iris was wringing her hands so hard that Cornelia would like to have slapped her for her silliness at a time like this.
"It's just that someone might see us from the house," Iris continued, "and people do think the wrong thing sometimes, don't they?"
"Oh, yes," said John Murray, "all the time."
"So if we could walk along the shore a little way, just out to the point there, we'd be out of sight of the house."
"If you say so," said Murray.
"I do hope you won't make your nice shiny shoes dusty," Iris said.
"That would be such a shame. Could I possibly hold on to your arm? I'm afraid I'll trip over something in the dark. It is so dark, isn't it?"
"I'll hold you up," said Cornelia impatiently. "Let's get on with it."
"Oh, no." Iris turned to Cornelia, and Cornelia saw a face of grim determination.
"You stay here, Cornelia. Please. We need someone to watch out in case anyone comes."
Cornelia would like to have argued, but she had never before seen such an expression on Iris's face. Maybe it was the face of the late Vernon DeVere, scion of the DeVere and Portnoy Empire. Maybe it was the face that had bought and sold boats and hotels and businesses from Cleveland to Chicago. Whatever the face was, it kept Cornelia firmly in her place. She watched Iris's white dress receding into the darkness. John Murray faded into the background almost immediately, but Iris was still visible, even when they reached the point. Their voices carried faintly on the night wind. Cornelia heard Iris's piping treble, punctuated occasionally by Mr. Murray's bass. Iris seemed to talk for a long time, her voice high and whining, perhaps explaining whatever useless document she expected Murray to sign. Cornelia saw a movement, which she took to be Iris opening her handbag, and then she heard Murray's sudden surprised shout. The shout was followed immediately by the sound of a gunshot. It ripped through the cold air, accompanied by the fluttering and calling of birds woken from their slumber. The figures at the point were too indistinct for Cornelia to make out what was happening, but she thought they were both on the ground.
All she could believe was that John Murray had shot poor Iris.
Her first reaction was to run away before he shot her as well. Then she recalled who she was. She was a woman of the 20th century, and such a woman would not run from gunfire. No, such a woman would defend her friend and not shirk her duty. She started to run to Iris's rescue, heedless of the roots which lay in wait to trip her feet and the branches whipping across her face. She ran breathlessly across the bank and out onto the small point of land thrusting into the Niagara River. Iris was on her feet. It was John Murray who lay on the ground.
"What on earth have you done?" Cornelia gasped.
"I've taken care of it," Iris said, and then she turned and threw something far out into the river. It landed with a splash.
"What do you mean you've taken care of it? What was that you threw?"
"His wallet," said Iris.
"Oh, dear, I think I'm rather faint. I think I'll have to sit down. You'll have to finish up here."
"What?"
"Him," said Iris. "Go on, Cornelia. Push him into the river. My strength is all gone. I feel as weak as a baby. You'll have to do it. Just roll him over and push him in."
"I can't do that," Cornelia said. "I can't touch him. Suppose he isn't, you know, dead. Suppose he opens his eyes."
"He won't," Iris said. "I'm a good shot. My daddy used to take me elk hunting. Elk are a lot harder to kill than men." Cornelia looked from Iris to the dead man and knew that her nerve was failing her.
"Don't talk like that," she said.
"I thought that was how women were supposed to talk," said Iris.
"I'm being what you wanted us all to be, Cornelia. I'm a woman who is solving her own problems. Isn't that what you wanted us to be, Cornelia?"
I never said we should be murderers. Murder by gunshot, murder by publicity stunt, it's all the same thing in the long run, Iris said. She staggered to her feet and took hold of one of John Murray's arms, trying to drag him to the riverbank. The side of the man's face scraped obscenely along the ground, and Cornelia stared in fascinated horror.
Come on, Cornelia, Iris urged. We have to get rid of him.
Reluctantly, Cornelia took the other arm, and together they dragged him to the water's edge.
He'll be found, Cornelia protested, determined to reassert her authority, and he'll be traced back to us.
Nonsense, said Iris. Push him in. They rolled Murray over, and he fell face downwards into the shallows, where he lay motionless with the waves breaking over him.
Damn, said Iris. He'll have to go out deeper. Push him out, Cornelia.
Why me? Cornelia asked.
I'm afraid of water, Iris responded.
Cornelia allowed herself a hollow but admiring laugh.
I don't think you're afraid of anything, she said.
Come on, Iris said. You have to do it.
Cornelia looked at the dead body and back at Iris. She pulled herself together, hoisted up her skirt, and stepped into the cold water.
She hadn't realized how cold the water would be.
Did Evangeline know how cold the water was?
With a great deal of pushing and shoving, she managed to haul the body into deeper water where it began to float.
Push it out, Iris urged from the shore. Go on, give it a good push.
Cornelia gave John Murray one large, good push, and to her surprise, the body was picked up in the current and whisked away rapidly downstream. Iris stood on the bank, clapping her little hands in triumph, and watched Cornelia wade ashore.
I knew it, she said. It's just as the boy said.
What boy?
The boy who was fishing this afternoon.
So that's why you wanted me to talk to him, Cornelia said.
Don't you remember what he said about the current? Iris asked.
Cornelia nodded. The body drifted away from sight.
Yes, Cornelia said. He said that if you fell in here, you wouldn't see land again until you reached the St. Lawrence River.
Cornelia stretched out a hand, and Iris helped her ashore.
Nothing to connect him with us, said Iris, and nothing to identify him as John Murray.
John Murray is already dead, Cornelia. Don't forget that. He took care of all the details himself a year ago.
But other people know he's alive, Cornelia argued.
Who?
His sons.
They won't say anything, Iris assured her.
How could they? They're the ones who reported him dead in the first place. They said he drowned, and now he has.
I think I took care of the problem very well.
It's not what I would have done, Cornelia said. Iris smiled cheerfully.
Of course it isn't. But you never were the practical one, dear. You know that. You stick to the speech-making and let me take care of the details. That's the way it's always been.
The logic was beyond argument, and so Cornelia said nothing. She had nothing left to say.
Iris patted her handbag. We women need something to even up the odds, she said. I think a gun makes all the difference. Maybe we should issue one to all of our members.
Don't be a fool, Cornelia snapped.
Iris grasped Cornelia's arm happily.
Good, she said. I see that you are yourself again. I was beginning to worry.
I'll never be myself again, Cornelia thought, staring at Iris in her muddy dress and wind-blown hair.
Where's her hat, she thought.
She was wearing a hat.
Evangeline. Evangeline was sure that she had heard a gunshot from somewhere close by.
Poachers, she assured herself.
The river was thick with wildfowl, so it made sense that there would be poachers. Many was the time that John had slipped out at night with a lantern to shoot a sitting duck. It was illegal, of course, and unsporting, but it was what she had come to expect of him, and it did put dinner on the table. Evangeline had the house to herself. Nell had taken the bus into town for the final meeting of the Women's Freedom Movement. Danny was still out with his uncle arranging the boat launching. Cornelia and Iris had taken themselves for a walk. Evangeline thought it was a rather cold night for walking, but she assumed that even Cornelia had become nervous, sitting in the house, watching the minutes and the hours ticking by, watching and waiting for tomorrow. Evangeline heard the front door open and then close, and then voices in the hall and on the stairs. At length, there came a timid knocking on her bedroom door. Iris stood at the door, wind-blown and battered, with mud all over her skirt and her hair a tangled mess.
What happened to you? Evangeline asked, standing aside to let the little woman through the doorway.
Oh, it's a terrible night, Iris said. I was practically blown off my feet.
You should be careful, Evangeline urged.
There are poachers about. I heard a gunshot.
Did you? Iris said vaguely.
I didn't.
Good thing, too, Evangeline thought. Poor Iris would probably faint dead away if she heard any loud noise at all.
Iris was standing in the middle of the room, wringing her hands in a gesture that was now familiar to Evangeline.
Sit down, said Evangeline. Iris shook her head. I have something to say to you, she said.
Yes?
Iris reached down and opened her handbag. She produced a crumpled paper, which she thrust into Evangeline's hands. You don't have to do it, she said.
Do what? Evangeline asked, although she knew it was a foolish question. There was only one thing that she had to do, and only one thing uppermost in everybody's minds.
You don't have to do it tomorrow.
Evangeline was tempted for a moment and then turned her back on the temptation.
Yes, I do, she said. I'm not going to let you down, Iris.
You wouldn't be letting me down, Iris said, and I don't give a fig about the whole stupid thing. Cornelia and Nell are the only ones who care. I tell you, dear, I never for one moment thought it would be so dangerous. I certainly wouldn't want to be responsible for anything happening to you. Here, take the contract. I'm giving it back to you. It wouldn't hold up in a court of law anyway. No one can be forced to kill themselves.
Evangeline took the folded paper and stared at its impressive wax seals.
That's that, then, said Iris. I feel so much better.
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute, Evangeline said. I wasn't doing this just because of the contract, you know.
Yes, you were, Iris insisted. I know what a bully Cornelia can be. I'm sure she had you convinced that there was no way out of it.
Iris, said Evangeline, if I had wanted to walk away, I'd have walked away, contract or no contract.
Is it the money? Iris asked. I could...
Now, don't be offended, please. I know people can be very touchy about money, but I have so much of it, and really it means nothing to me. I could let you have some money.
Evangeline shook her head.
No, it's not just the money. It's exactly as I've said all along, Iris. I want to make my mark in the world. I don't want to have just lived and died. I want to be someone.
For the cause, Iris agreed.
No, said Evangeline, risking an honest answer. I don't give a damn about the cause. I want this for me.
And what about Mr. McLaren? Iris asked.
Evangeline felt her face redden.
Were there no secrets in this town?
What about Mr. McLaren? She asked.
Iris turned away from her and looked out of the window at the blowing trees and racing clouds.
He deserves to be happy, she said softly. And you can make him happy. All I want is that he should be happy.
There was a sudden catch in her voice. Evangeline hesitated and then laid a hand on the other woman's shoulder.
Iris? She asked.
Iris turned toward her. There were tears in her eyes.
You could make him happy, Iris said.
Evangeline looked at her in amazement.
Do you love him that much? She asked softly.
Iris shrugged her thin shoulders.
I don't know, she said. I don't know much about love. I just want him to be happy.
Evangeline started to protest, but Iris silenced her.
I don't fool myself, she said. He doesn't want me. He hasn't given me a second glance. I'll never be in your way, but I'd like to think that he could have what he wants. I'd like to think of someone looking after him. All he needs is affection.
She wiped a tear from her eyes and smiled hesitantly. He's not what you think, she continued.
Do you know that he grew all those roses in the garden? I've watched him tending them. He has very gentle hands. They're badly scarred. I don't know why, but they're very gentle.
I know, Evangeline thought, remembering the initial gentleness of his scarred hands and how she had felt the roughness of the scars against her skin. She and Joshua had been as physically intimate as a man and woman could be, and yet it seemed that it was Iris who had truly appreciated the soul of the man.
I can't do anything for him, Evangeline said. I can't stay here.
Iris patted her handbag knowingly and winked.
Yes, you can, she said.
It's not just the money, Evangeline said.
No, of course not, Iris agreed. I know that there's something else standing in your way.
Well, don't worry about it. It's not in your way any longer.
Evangeline stared.
Did Iris know about John Murray's resurrection? What was she hinting at?
Had she paid John off? Perhaps that was it. Apparently money was no problem with Iris. She knew she would have to tell Iris the truth. "It's no good paying him," she said. "He'll come back."
"Who will, dear?"
"The man we're talking about."
"Oh, yes, the man we're talking about. Is he the reason why you have to leave?"
Evangeline nodded her head in silent agreement. Iris smiled again. "He won't be back," Iris said firmly.
"You don't know him," Evangeline insisted.
Iris walked over and closed the drapes, taking one last look at the windblown sky. "I did hear the gunshot you were talking about," she said.
"Poachers?" Evangeline said automatically.
Iris shook her head. "No, not poachers." She patted her handbag again.
"He won't be back, Evangeline. Not ever.
All I ask is that you do the right thing.
Make him happy, Evangeline. You're the only one who can."
She gave Evangeline a sudden, shy hug and hurried out the door, leaving Evangeline alone, numb with shock, staring at the clock and counting the hours and minutes of the long night. Evangeline returned to the window to look out again at the windblown clouds and the intermittent moonlight. The gusty winds rattled the old window frame, and cold air blew in around the edges. How cold was the night, she wondered. How cold was the river water?
What would it be like? Would the barrel leak? Would she be immersed in freezing water?
No, that wasn't possible.
If the barrel was airtight, then it was watertight. She wouldn't feel the water, but she would feel the cold. Why on earth had she agreed to wear a bathing suit? Why not warm clothes? Why not long underwear? Why on earth had she agreed to this?
The moon floated free of the clouds, and she saw a solitary figure walking along the riverbank.
Joshua.
She recognized everything about him, from his height to his distinctive long stride. But what was he doing? Why was he walking along the riverbank? Perhaps he'd heard the gunshot and was out looking for the poacher. If it was a poacher, and according to Iris, it was definitely not a poacher. Joshua stopped and bent over and picked up something from the ground. She could see it was a white object. She recognized the shape. It was a hat. She thought about Iris and her windblown hair. Iris, who never went out without a hat. Had Joshua found Iris's hat? She saw Joshua looking around, kicking the bushes, stooping down to examine the rocks at the water's edge. Eventually, he stood up, and with a quick motion, he hurled the hat into the water and watched as it drifted off downstream. Given the quantity of ribbons and ornamentations usually adorning one of Iris's hats, Evangeline imagined that it would sink like a stone within a couple of minutes. Sink like a stone, she thought. Sink like a stone and disappear without a trace. Please God that it would do that. Joshua walked out away from sight. Evangeline saw that she was still holding the contract that Iris had thrust upon her. She tore it in two and crumpled the remains. She knew that she had spoken the truth to Iris when she said that the contract meant nothing to her. Contracts were just words on paper. The river was life and death. A light came on in the boat shed. Joshua, adjusting the barrel one final time, or perhaps he was just sitting, as she was, staring at the clock and counting the hours. Poor Joshua. So honorable, so upright, so high-minded. Iris would be so much better for him. She would have cooked and cleaned for him, smiled for him, and loved him, and never brought scandal down on his head. But could Iris have done for him what Evangeline had done? Could she ever have offered him passion and daring and wild lovemaking in the spring moonlight? Could Iris have made him laugh? Could Iris have made him cry? Iris could not, and she knew it, and so she had released him to the woman who could. She had done something so drastic and so appalling that Evangeline could hardly even think of it. She had risked everything so that Evangeline could be a free woman. And what had she asked in return? Only that Evangeline would stay alive and not cause Joshua any more grief. It wasn't so much to ask. Evangeline sat down at the dressing table, picked up a pen, and began to write. Dear Joshua. No, that was too formal. My dear Joshua. That was better. Now what? The letter would be her surrender. If he didn't want her to go over the falls, then she wouldn't do it.
She would accept the chance to live, but only if they could find a way to be together.
Yes, that was the best way to put it. If he wanted her, and if he was willing to deal with a scandal, then she would be his. She would put the choice in his hands, and he would choose her. She knew he would.
She wrote the letter in the distinctive turquoise ink she always used. A small voice at the back of her mind was telling her that the letter wasn't really surrender. It was just another kind of contract.
"Tell him you love him," the small voice said, "because you know that you do."
"Later," she told the small voice. "I'll tell him later, when I know if I can trust him with my love."
"It's not what Iris asked you to do," the small voice said.
"It's all I can offer," she replied. She looked out the window. The light in the boat shed had gone out. She folded the note and went back downstairs. The parlor was empty. She walked quickly through the back of the house and knocked on Joshua's bedroom door, hoping that he would not be there already. This was something she couldn't do in person. She had to leave him to read the note and make his own decision. The door was unlocked. She pushed it open and looked inside. Not much of a room. A narrow bed, a dressing table with a brush and comb, a washstand, and a photograph on the nightstand. In the dim light from the passage, she picked up the photo and stared at it. It was a sepia-toned picture taken long ago and showing a plump young woman with a mass of light-colored hair. She had dimpled cheeks and full pouting lips. Evangeline sighed and returned the picture to its place. Joshua had his memories. But then, so did she. They would both have to learn to live with that. She decided not to leave the note in the bedroom. What if he failed to return? What if he was planning to spend the night guarding one or the other of the boats? What if he was planning to spend it in drinking or talking? He would probably need some company to see him through the long night hours. She crossed the road to the boat shed. She would pin the note to the top of the barrel. That way he wouldn't miss it. The door of the shed was locked. She circled the building looking for an open window and eventually found one, high up and out of reach. She spent a few more minutes piling up old paint cans to make a stepladder. It was unpleasant work in the cold and the dark, with occasional sprinkles of rain, but eventually she finished her construction, climbed the pile of paint cans, levered open the window, and began to crawl in, head first. She barely had her head in through the window when the paint cans collapsed under her. She found herself falling backwards into the darkness. She landed with a sickening thud, and the night turned suddenly black.